He must have suffered some kind of a complete mental breakdown. He ran amok and, he killed his family with an axe. Stacked them neatly in one of the rooms of the West Wing, and then he put both barrels of a shotgun in his mouth.
All right.
Here we go.
We are taking on a monster.
I'm scared. Not gonna lie.
Whose idea was this?
You came up with this one. I don't even know if we're, are we even qualified to talk about it? I don't know.
Well, you're right. It's a movie that's been analyzed, written about, talked about. I'm sure there's a college class somewhere about The Shining, but what we can do is we can talk about our experience with it. And I was, well, I'll get to it, but this is a crazy, crazy experience for me in watching a film, and I'll get to that. And I think this episode is going to be a lot of me interviewing you, basically, because I have so many questions about this film that you're going to know more than I do about it. So I think that might be the kind of form of me going like, well, what does this mean? And why did he do that? And what do you think that means?
Open to interpretation, this one, man.
All right, good. Welcome to Rated P for Paranormal. All right, we've got so much to get to before we get to The Shining. And in fact, you know what? We have a junk drawer segment we do of things we never got to. And it's right now bursting at the seams. So why don't we do this? Let me set the table a little bit. Why don't we get to the junk drawer? Because there's like five or six things I think we never got to. We will get to The Shining, and we're going to end the show as usual with our top three list inspired by the movie that we are reviewing. So Tony, what's our top three list inspired by The Shining?
Our top three is the top three baseball moments, baseball bat moments, baseball bat moments in film.
It's so good. You know, I don't think we need to explain that to you if you've seen even images of The Shining. So the greatest baseball bat moments in film history.
It's the Grand Slam.
All right. Let's see what's in this. Let's see what's in this drawer, Tony. Sorry. Let's see what's in this drawer, Tony.
Maybe your dentures.
Now it's time for the stuff we didn't get to.
What a piece of junk.
P4P junk drawer.
All right. So first of all, Tony, you've got a few things in this drawer that are taking up space. Would you please clean your side out before we?
Yes. I'm sorry. It's a mess.
Okay. Thank you.
Let me organize some of this. The first bit of news, which was really fun. I found out that our movie Sender is now available on Amazon Prime. For Prime members, it's now part of the service streaming. So you don't have to rent it if you're a Prime member. I thought that was really nice. It's going to be a lot more available. You know, it's really hard for people to want to spend any money on an unknown quantity. I'm the same way. So it's cool that it's more available. That's part one. Part two, more importantly, the last 2 weeks have been frenetic because my wife, Amelia, has been rehearsing a show. It's her first show back to New York theater since the pandemic. And they open tomorrow night, and it's going really well. Previews are awesome. And the show's called Coal Country. It's at the Cherry Lane Theater, and it's a very moving, powerful show with a lot of music in it by Steve Earle, who's also in the show.
Yes.
Every night singing original music. It's a great time.
Didn't she do that before? I remember her doing a play with Steve Earle. Is this the same play?
It's the same play. And they opened a week before everything shut down 2 years ago or more. And so they never got a run, and they finally got to redo the show and actually really do it. The show is amazing. So that's been really cool.
Dig it, man. Congrats. I told you 2022 is going to be good for the Arkans.
So far, so good. Yeah. Thanks for your good vibes.
Yeah, man. That's great. Well, so you can rent Sender. I love that. That's huge news. And you can just stream it.
Right? Yeah, stream it. You don't have to rent it.
You don't even have to rent it.
Oh, it's going to play. It might even play without you, but you just got to make sure it's not playing without you saying the play. It could be annoying.
Right. that is such great news. And congratulations to Amelia. She must be so happy to be like doing live theater again, because I know that's her jam.
yep, she's really happy, and it's great to see her, you know, doing what she loves. It's great.
And I would imagine crowds are like super happy to be back in
you know, yeah, it's theater. An appreciative audience of, right. of people going back to the theater, you know, and actually feeling kind of safe doing it. So it's cool.
I have a little thing here next to these useless pens here and some rolled up
right.
rubber bands. Kerrig Taylor, super fan Kerrig, he sent me a picture of a, and you'll know if you listen to last week's episode, he sent me a picture of a photo mat kiosk in a parking lot from, it looks like the 70s. He said, this showed up in my Facebook feed just as I was finishing listening to the latest ep where Maddie mentions a photomat kiosk. Look at this. And it says, like, remember these? And he's like, that. Now, Kerrig's the same guy who, in my other podcast, I mentioned something. I feel like it was, I told the story about like a bird hitting a window or something. And as it was, he was listening to it, something hit his windshield. So yeah, we have some sort of crazy vibe going with him.
Okay. Well, we appreciate everything Kerrig does for this show. He's been extremely helpful in helping us keep organized. And
yes,
he's been invaluable.
And just full disclosure, I no longer go inside photo mats with 19-year-old babysitters.
When did you stop doing that?
About 6 months ago.
Okay. Okay.
Are we recording it?
I can remember when I was a little boy. My grandmother and I could hold conversations entirely without ever opening our mouths. She called it shining. And for a long time, I thought it was just the two of us that had the shine to us. Just like you probably thought you was the only one. But there are other folks, though mostly they don't know it or don't believe it.
Well, Tony, not going to set this one up the usual way because if you haven't seen The Shining or are not aware of the plot of The Shining, I doubt you're listening to this podcast. I would recommend that you go back and watch it before we talk now, hit pause, go back and watch it if it's been a long time, because for me, it had been a long time since I sat and watched it all the way through. We're not going to spend much time like explaining the plot. I think that'd be kind of a waste of time. Like,
yeah.
And then what happens is like, yeah, it's the
same. Yeah, no.
But I do have so many questions, and this was a super powerful experience for me because, you know, you grow with movies, you grow with your favorite musical artists, you grow with the art that you watch. And I definitely grew with this one. Now, funny story. And I think I've mentioned this in the podcast before. I saw The Shining way too young. It was like a bad 1970s parent moment for my parents, or I guess early 80. As I remember the story now, I might be conflating stories here and mixing them up in my childhood memory. It might've been a separate time we're at the movie theater, but I remember the movie theater that they took me to when I saw The Shining. And I feel like we went to go see The Empire Strikes Back. Could they have been in the theater at the same time?
Yeah, it's possible.
Okay. I just remember there was a Darth Vader in the lobby. And
yeah, it's entirely possible. Okay. Yeah, I don't remember the exact dates for both releases, but yeah.
But close enough. And so there was a Darth Vader in the lobby. And my guess is we went to go see something else. It wasn't available or whatever. And we went and saw The Shining. And I remember distinctly my mother covering my eyes when the naked lady came out of the tub, but nobody covered my eyes when he got Scatman Crothers with a pickaxe in the hallway. No,
or the rest of the movie, which is really, yeah. You shouldn't really see.
No, so I saw it way too young. And of course, it's one of those movies that I know every scene really well, but I haven't sat down and watched it start to finish in a very long time. And oh my God, as a creative artist type with a bit of a temper, who was just in quarantine with my wife and son, this one hit home in ways that I didn't quite expect it to.
It does resonate with the lockdown experience, this movie. It really does. Yeah.
And it said different things to me than it's ever said in the past for those reasons. You know, I got themes that I didn't get in the past. And honestly, Tony, a lot of it came from doing this podcast as an exercise. Like, I've kind of learned how to organize my thoughts when watching a movie and look for different things more than ever before. So yeah, this was really incredible. This one rocked me. This is The Shining for a reason. It's a classic for a reason.
Okay, good. I mean, I'm glad you had a good experience. You know, in a lot of ways. I mean, I've read a lot about it. I'm a Kubrick nut, so I've read a lot of books about Kubrick, and I've watched all his movies kind of obsessively. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's not necessarily something I'm proud of. It's just like it is like sometimes unhealthy in a way. Like I can't stop reading about it.
I love that. I love when someone has like a nerd thing that they just nerd out on and drill down on. It's great.
But I've been doing that for so long, and I've been reading about him for so long that in a way it's hard for me to talk about, because I don't even know what my own feelings are and where I've read other people's feelings, and they become part of my own feelings about the movie. You know what I mean?
Yes,
I've read so many reviews and books about it and essays and other people's takes. And over the last 30 years of this obsession, you know, have a hard time figuring out what's generally my experience and what is just what I've learned about it, you know? So, you know, I obviously love it. I'm pretty much in awe of it and all of his stuff. And I guess, I mean, you know, a lot of people are, he's considered one of the great artists of the 20th century and all that stuff. But, two things, his movies are really entertaining too. I think they're really funny and really great for an audience to see and be, you know, horrified by and shocked by. And also then they're really, really endlessly deep and can take all that examination. Yeah. And that's an amazing combo. You know, yeah. A lot of movies that are this examined are maybe more art movies in terms of their style and pacing, or they're much slower or cerebral. And this is all that, but it's also a blockbuster, you know, it's amazing.
Oh, and also I should note, Lucky You, a film that has a incredibly close connection to the Rocky franchise, with Tony Burton appearing in the film, which I completely forgot.
Duke. Luckily, from Rocky. We have no trouble segueing into Rocky at all.
I'll never not find a way. I'm like, oh my God, it's Duke. I forgot Duke was in this movie.
You're making a case for Rocky being the most important central film ever made.
It's the what's the character?
That's the Kevin Bacon. It's the Kevin Bacon of movies.
Yes. Well, what's that? There's a character like who's everywhere in history. I forget the term, but like, you know, yeah, Forrest Gump, I guess.
I'll take that. Sure. you said it. I didn't.
So yeah, I mean, what scared me in this viewing is so radically different than what scared me in the past about it. You know, like for me, the scariest scenes in this movie had to do with trying to parent that child and every moment that came therein. You know, like the doctor scene at the beginning, maybe my sneaky favorite scene in the movie, Shelley Duvall tries to convince the doctor and herself.
Played by the great Ann Jackson.
Man.
Yeah.
And she describes how Danny had an injury, quote unquote, and it was, you know, child abuse, and she tries to kind of laugh it off, and you see this panic look in her eyes and this horrible smile of her just trying to, you know, it happens, and dad's trying to grab the kid, and then the doctor just doesn't give her any quarter, just no reaction, staring her down. It's like, oh my God, what a scene that is.
I guess Danny started talking to Tony about the time we put him in nursery school.
Did he adjust well to school?
No. He didn't like it too much at first. And then he had an injury, so we kept him out for a while. And yeah, I guess that's about the time when I first noticed that he was talking to Tony.
What sort of injury did he have?
He dislocated his shoulder.
How did he manage to do that?
Well, it was just one of those things, you know, purely an accident.
Yeah, it's incredible. It's one of my favorites, too. I tend to go, you know, I love the whole movie, but the setup of this movie to me is where I go back again and again. I'll dip into the scenes in the first 40 minutes of setting up this hotel and these characters, and the menace that's going on underneath the surface of all of it is just the pressure and the tension of it is almost unbearable. And it's all this kind of surface nicety, which is Kubrick's kind of thing. Like people aren't very fancy in his movies. The dialogue is pretty spare. You know, mm-hmm. the interactions are almost completely banal, you know, mm-hmm. in terms of just the dialogue. But it's just what's going on under the surface that from the very beginning of this movie just sets you off on edge that something is terribly, terribly wrong from the beginning. And it's funny, this movie got some flack. Famously, Stephen King hates the movie.
Yeah. Okay. That was one of my questions. Why? What didn't he like about this that you
know? Well, I mean, not to belabor it, there's a lot of stuff online about it. Essentially, I think he saw Jack Torrance as a sympathetic character, as somebody who was struggling, but a good man who was consumed by this hotel, by these evil things. And Kubrick really kind of presents somebody that is kind of demented from the beginning of the movie.
Yeah.
He's clearly got he's clearly kind of off from the first moment we see him. And well,
that crushing pressure you're talking about really is coming from him.
Yes.
You know, we haven't seen any of it. We're just hearing about it, but you can feel it. You can see
it. I mean, he's a guy that, you know, he's abusive. We know that. We know he abused his kid. And in my sense now is far worse than either of them pretend or let on.
Of course. Right.
His alcoholism was so terrifying to Shelley Duvall's character, and even talking about it, you can see her hand trembling when she's just lighting a cigarette, talking to this doctor about mundane stuff.
Yes.
So she's probably been horribly abused by this guy. But we don't get to see that. We just see the after effects, the psychological damage that was done, that everybody's trying to kind of just keep everything under the rug and together long enough. But anyway, Stephen King's main point, I think, was that he didn't like that take on it. And he I think, really associated with this book. He felt he was Jack Torrance when he was writing it.
Sure.
And that he didn't want to think of himself. And then when the book was really about his problems with drugs and alcohol, you know, and his own struggle with that, he didn't want to, on top of that, I think, see this character as a, you know, corrupt from the beginning.
Got it.
I think it bothered him a lot.
That makes sense. That makes sense. I get that. You know, this movie hit home for me in so many ways. I'm glad you mentioned alcoholism because I was going to get into that. I think in a lot of ways, this movie's an allegory for alcoholism and undealt with, swept under the rug family issues, and that the hotel could be seen as just the giant bar or the giant drug or the giant drink that someone who suffers from this goes through.
Yeah.
You know, you mentioned the shaking hand, the trembling hand. Like, my experience in my life has been, and not to reveal too much, but I don't care. It's my podcast. I can, you know, like, there's a long history in my family tree of this type of thing, of kind of that level of abuse and self-abuse, you know, disease, the disease of alcoholism and things like that. And then the effect it has on the people around them. So you get a lot of high anxiety, especially with the women in the family.
Yeah.
A lot of fear, a lot of repressed anxiety, huge crippling anxiety, where you had a lot of people that were in my life that had shaking hands and chain smoked and, you know, just to do something, to have somewhere to put that level of anxiety. And then there's also this mom and son thing, and the dad and son thing versus dad. And, you know, my house is like the Disney version of The Shining, but it's there. Like, I'm kind of the monster in the house because, you know, Colleen and Max have this bond that I just can't access, but I always feel like I'm clodding in to this happy little world they have with my dad, man. Shit. Is that,
well, I think that's very, I mean, I think that, is kind of what Kubrick was on about with this movie in part. I think he was doing a lot of things, but I think definitely this is an examination of, and I know you hate this word and I kind of hate it too, male toxicity or whatever that is, but we can agree that there is something that is a kind of a masculine trait that can be quite destructive. And I think he was fearlessly kind of looking at that in this movie. And it was all based on, you know, the research he was doing to make the film was all like Freudian analysis and the Oedipal complex and all these like, and then archetypal fairy tale myths kind of combined to try to pinpoint not only just what was most terrifying to people, because he was trying to actually research what the most scary things were, that he would put them all in the movie one way or another, awesome. But also because he was dealing with like basic human psychology, it's about all of us. Like we all have pieces of Torrance in us or a little bit of Wendy in us or some of Danny, you know, and that family dynamic, that myth is there for a reason. Cause it's really about families and how destructive they can be, but how they can also save you, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, to me, it's just like an endless topic of discussion. You can enter this movie in almost any angle and start really dissecting it. And I would like to get to that, like to mention later that documentary Room 237, which is about The Shining and all the theories and conspiracy theories about it.
Yes.
Which is another weird and interesting angle on it.
You know, it all ties in. I think so I watched that documentary some years ago. I think I was on the Metro North train, so I was still in New York. So it was a few years ago. So it's funny. It was in my mind watching this time. The only one I could kind of buy was that whole Native American angle with the blood and some of the decor and things like that. I don't know. Did he ever admit to putting anything in this movie like that?
There was a theory in Room 237 that Kubrick was the man that the CIA paid to fake the moon landing and shoot that. I don't believe that at all for a second. But, you know, it's a fun theory. I think there are things that they cover in 237 that are all true. And I think a lot of them are true. And I think one of the weird things about that movie, and I really like that documentary, but it's more about people than it is about The Shining.
Yeah. It's about
It's about what people want to see in things and what they demand the reason for something is. And in each case, each person who had a theory was like, no, this is what The Shining is about.
Yeah. It's like watching a UFO documentary.
Right. But I think part of it was like, I was looking at it kind of like, well, how many movies have you all seen? Or great movies? Like a lot of great movies are about all these things, right. You know? Yeah. It's about, you know, the subjugation of the native people here and about commercialism building on top of ancient burial grounds and that coming back to haunt us. Yeah. That's in the movie.
Yeah.
That's not accidental. That's right. It's mentioned even in the dialogue. Mentioned.
That's right. Yes.
You know?
Yes.
And people talk about the moon landing stuff. I see the space thing, but I think he's more riffing on the fact that this movie is the closest thing to 2001. I think that he made, I think this and 2001 are kind of companion pieces in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. They're made very similarly, you know, they have a similar like size and scope. And technically both very hard to achieve. And I think he was riffing off of that and commenting. He does a lot of comments about his own movies in other movies. So no, do I think it means that he faked the moon landing? No. But do I think that he was referencing 2001? Yeah, it's all there.
Yeah.
One of the crazy things about his movies, and I'll stop talking too much because I know we both have a lot to say about this, but it's a remarkable thing to see a film where what you're seeing is exactly what was intended, I believe. Because he had unlimited time and resources pretty much to make what he wanted, what you're seeing is not accidental. It's not like he didn't intend for this end result. If you've got a problem with it, it's not necessarily on you, but you have to deal with the fact that it's not an accident. It's very much part of the design of the movie, I think, almost more than any other filmmaker. His movies end up being more like architecture to me. It's like going into a building or an incredible physical space. It's like it wouldn't occur to me to be like to walk into the Vatican and go like, this would be amazing if only they had kind of done it like this. No, you're just kind of walking through this mind, this maze that he's created. And I don't know. It's just like so endlessly fascinating.
Yeah. It's, It's an incredible accomplishment. And the way he ratchets up the dread slowly, you see Jack slowly start to get worse and worse and worse. And as the billboards of the day and the time goes by, those cutaways to, you know, Tuesday, 8 a.m., yeah, you know, he's getting a little worse and a little worse each time.
And it gets faster and faster, yes, as it goes, you know.
Yes. Yeah. Until we're just there and you don't need him anymore. You know what I mean? They kind of stop at a certain point. And I kind of realize in this viewing, like, oh yeah, we're there. Like the build is over. He's fully possessed. Yeah. We're gone. We're,
yeah. You know, yeah.
Yeah. It's just, there's so many layers. And that, I want to get back to that mom and son thing. And like, we've run into this theme before in some other films, but I think this is the most artful way it's ever been dealt with and the most intense way it's ever been dealt with. You know, in some ways you could also look at this as not only Jack's story, but Danny's story and the fear of, and this came up recently in another movie, like the fear of adulthood, the fear of becoming a, yes, man himself. Right. And,
yes,
and, there's a scene where he holds Danny and they have this great dialogue. And he goes, "You wouldn't hurt us, would you, Daddy?" And he's looking, and the way they're looking at each other and the way it's shot, I'm like, this little kid is looking at him going like, is this what you'd become? You become this monster with all these, yeah, outside pressures, you know? And Jack Nicholson talks about that. He's like, you know, do you understand the pressures I have under me? And this is my last shot. And I think every guy, for right or for wrong, most guys, I think, have that kind of, that we put that pressure on ourselves, that world pressure. We are the providers and we might have a, yeah, dream to make it.
And our society puts that on us. I mean, that's, I think in the way that all Kubrick movies are kind of comments on society, he's very into that, you know?
Yeah.
And I think he sees that as being a fundamental problem in our,
yeah,
in how we treat each other and how men are treated and what men, you know, what men carry around in them that they're not expressing in a healthy way.
Yes.
This pressure. And it oftentimes does end up with in abuse and terrible kind of catastrophe. You know, I mean, not all the time, but there's enough of it around to go like, man, what can we all do to stop this chain of, yeah, of thing happening?
Yes. There's, you know, there's a scene that's so heartbreaking. And I mentioned things that terrified me now compared to what used to terrify me. And it's a scene where she first comes into him typing and offers him a couple sandwiches. Shelley Duvall. It's the first time he yells at her.
Yep.
He says, you know, you come in here, you're breaking my concentration. He does that whole monologue, which is,
yeah, whether you're beyond, typing or whether, oh, I'm not typing, whatever the hell it is you hear me doing.
You sound, yeah, like, that's a good impression.
Whenever you come in here and interrupt me, you're breaking my concentration. You're distracting me. And it will then take me time to get back to where I was. Understand?
Yeah.
Fine. And we're going to make a new rule. Whenever I'm in here, you hear me typing. Whether you don't hear me typing, whether the fuck you hear me doing in here, when I'm in here, that means that I am working. That means don't come in. How do you think you can handle that?
Yeah.
It's just a stunning piece of acting by both of them, but it's also like, it ruined me. I had a huge lump in my throat because all I could think of was like, how many times have my wife and child been in their happy little bubble? Or she comes up to me to say, oh, we got to do this. And I'm like, can you just, you know, and you just like, and her defeat, her hurt, the way she handles that is, and I go, dude, like, how many times has my man energy, like,
yeah,
you know, and of course, I'm much, it's not at that level. I'm not an abusive husband, I swear to God. But do you know what I mean? Like,
I really do. I mean, I really think that's why the movie has this lasting power. It's not because it's the scariest movie ever made, although I think it's certainly one of them. It's because it's dealing with things in a way that, in a similar way that The Exorcist does, though in a very different way.
Mm.
It's dealing with very human issues that we all deal with in fear and fear.
Yes.
And we recognize, you know, characters going through situations by what they don't say and what they, you know, I mean, these performances are so finely tuned and so incredible. God. And I just have to say that for me, as I watch this movie now, I mean, I don't know how many times I've seen it. I feel like it's Wendy's movie.
Yeah.
I mean, needless to say, Shelley Duvall rules the universe with a performance that I don't think there's enough that you can be said about it. I mean, first of all, yeah, she suffered a lot to give us this performance. It should be said that she suffered willingly. She did say she was glad she made this movie, but I think the process was really painful. And to Nicholson's credit, he did say he was very sad that she didn't get the kind of recognition that at the time that she deserved, because he said he'd never seen an actor work as hard in his life. And he was working as hard as you could imagine too. So for her to try to keep up with Nicholson and take that kind of abuse and do 100 takes of sobbing, crying hysteria and nail it to that level, I don't know. I just think she's incredible.
I want to say this, and I'm prone to hyperbole, but I think the image of her screaming against the wall in the bathroom when he finally breaks through the door, the fear on her face might be the most intense fear I've ever seen captured on film.
Yeah, I agree.
I've never, right? It's like, hard to watch, actually. But it's like you're watching a documentary about killing or something.
It's painful. She is so open a wound at that point. She's been through so much.
Oh my
God. And
it's like she almost levels it up herself. You can almost see her go through, like she's scared, and then she levels it up. Like, do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Well, as a master class in horror acting, it hits every single note, like every note on the scale of types of horror, types of reactions to things that you could have that are unnerving and scary. And watching her, you know, she's without her, there's no movie at all. I mean, there isn't. She's the heart and soul of it. She's the anchor of it. She's why we care. We're scared because she's scared.
Yes.
And,
yes.
And I also want to say in support of her and her character, because she's gotten a lot of slams over the years, or that character has, people do take pot shots at her being like, you know, annoying, or like, you know, that of course, like he's driven to this because he's married to somebody that's so like neurotic or something.
Right.
But they're missing the point because they don't realize that she's been abused by him for the last, probably for years now. And you're seeing somebody who's already broken.
Yes, exactly.
He's already broken.
Exactly. And that ties into what I was leading with, is that level of, she does an incredible job right from Jump Street.
Yeah.
That smile, that big, fake smile with the empty eyes. And like
covering it all up.
Yeah. It happens. You know, this kind of thing. I mean, Jack works very hard, and it's like, it's horrifying. You mentioned she's scared. We're scared because she's scared. And it's so funny. It is her movie in so many ways, because you hit on something that I subconsciously realized, but now I'm realizing directly. And that is, Jack a few times actually gets almost campy broad in this. He's phenomenal, but there's like one or two moments where he has a wide range in going through what he's going through as an actor that he uses. He uses all of his palette of his toolbox, and some of them are lighter than others. And there are times when you got to go like, oh, that's funny. And then they show her and you're like, it's not funny. And that's when the fear comes in. Like, you're exactly right. Like, this thing could have been a lot less scary if it wasn't for her.
Yeah. I feel like he uses that a lot. It's a great thing in horror. I feel like fear is infectious, and it's a really great device in horror movies to show people being afraid of something. Somehow their reactions to something that we're not even seeing yet become really, really terrifying. It happens early in the doctor scene. Yeah. Ann Jackson plays this doctor, is kind of a local doctor, comes to do a checkup on the boy. And she's not a social worker or anything, but she's starting to get a weird vibe, maybe that something's not right in this house. Shelley Duvall starts shaking, you know, she's nervous. She says, oh, he just broke his arm and it's nothing. And, you know, it's just an accident and he's not drinking anymore and it's fine. And there's a shot of Ann Jackson looking at her, and she is very still. She doesn't have much of a reaction, but if you look at her eyes, she's looks to me to be terrified. Ann Jackson seems to be picking up on something not okay. that is terrifying her. And probably she doesn't even quite know what it is. But her response is what makes you terrified in that scene. And it just grows and grows.
And Shelley Duvall looks for the out. You know, she's looking. She says to the doctor something to the effect of like, but you know how it is. These things happen, right?
Mm-hmm.
And she just does not react.
Just stares.
Just stares her down. It's like, no, that's not,
not okay.
Yeah, it's phenomenal. It's what Shelley Duvall's character would have given for him to just like be happy in that apartment, be happy with his life as it is. And appreciate the son he has. I mean, you know what I mean? Like that. You're watching the effects of years of her trying to get him to that point, and just
right. But there's so much psychosis right in that little exchange right there. Right. I mean, right in that problem, because we can say like, oh well, he's driven by this thing of I have to supply to be, you know, be the breadwinner, and I've got to do this and that. But he doesn't do anything.
Right. Well, that's
he sits around.
That's right.
Goes insane. And writes the same sentence over and over again. And she is running the place on the phone with the sheriff, taking care of the kid, doing all the cooking and the cleaning, everything. And yet he has the audacity, like a lot of guys do, like that typical, like the lion out in the day, all they do is they roar and they bitch and they moan.
Bluster. It's all bluster.
And the women are doing all the work. And now that's not always the case, but it certainly is the case with a certain kind of family and a certain kind of man. And it's just so perfectly explained without histrionics, you know, without her having to be aware of her position. What I love about the movie is that she doesn't talk about standing up for herself or say like, listen, I'm a woman and you can't talk to me that
way. She never lists all the things she does.
We just simply watch her develop into a warrior by the end of the movie and do things you'd never think she could do at the beginning of the film. You know,
we talk about like Laurie Strode and these characters, like why doesn't Shelley Duvall come up more? Let's just talk horror for a second, just as in you're a horror expert, like she does everything right. She does everything right. Like everything that a character like that in a movie like this frustrates you, like, oh, putting the gun down and turning their back to the killer. So she does none of that. She knocks him out. She drags him and locks him in a cooler. Like, yes.
Yeah.
She sends her son out the window and gives him instructions. She gets the cat going.
And she really confront him when she has evidence that Danny's been hurt and she knows she didn't do it. And they're the only three people there. She actually confronts him.
Yep.
And she's scared to do it, but she does it. She's always doing the right thing. And she's great.
So I just want to talk about some of the off-screen things that were going on, like with her in particular, with Stanley Kubrick. So I've read just a little bit about it, not a lot. And they just recently did a Vanity Fair article, I think it was, with her. She doesn't do interviews, but it just came out pretty recently, like within the last year and a half or so.
Before the pandemic, but
it was. Okay, so let's say 2 years ago, you saw that article. So a writer like found her, they somehow got to her. She's in like, I think, want to say Northern California, maybe.
I think so. And she'd fallen on somewhat hard times.
Yes. And I just got a sense that, and I don't know this, but like, I feel like maybe in some degree, she never quite recovered from the process of making this movie.
And Kubrick really did do some mind trips on her during the filming. To kind of increase the pressure and not let it off of her at all. He was pretty, he never yelled at her from what I've heard.
Mm-hmm.
The people that say that he yelled at her, they're not really, there's a videotape making of The Shining. You can see some of these interactions. He treats her pretty rough, without any sympathy. He tells people in her presence, don't give Shelley any sympathy, she's not going to help her. And he kind of berates her a little bit, and he kind of like says, hey, come on, Shelley, you're wasting our time. Like, he pushes her and pushes her, needles her. I don't believe he yelled at her, screamed at her, because he wasn't known to be yet. He never raised his voice, apparently. It wasn't his style. Was he manipulative? Yes. You know, was this something that in the end, even years later, she says she was glad she went through and proud of doing? Yes. I want to respect her enough to give her the final word on it.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
She's a great actress. She's fantastic. One of the great film actors of her generation. And if she tells me this was worth it, that's good enough for me. I don't need to overanalyze it.
Totally, yeah.
But
I was wondering if you thought maybe that she'd shied away from making many more movies, that because it seems to be that I think she did.
I know that she did not do, I don't think she did a ton of acting after that. She may have taken a long break. I know she did get into producing and was not, you know, so messed up by the experience that she didn't go on and produce Fairy Tale Theater and create and direct that show and do a lot of really interesting stuff. I think she may have, you know, taken a breather from acting or something to kind of focus on other things. But she, there's only one other performance that you can kind of equate it to. Did you ever see a movie called Possession? It's a European equivalent of The Shining, maybe in a way. It's terrifying. And Isabel Adjani, a European actress, is in this and goes to similarly intense places. They're kind of similar. And both actors say they were proud they did it, but would never do it again.
I need to keep a journal of movies like you do, because I think sometimes you say, have you seen this? I go, no. And then I look and I go, oh my God, I did see this. Right. You recommended it to me 7 years ago or 10 years ago or 12 years ago.
And also I'm old and forget everything.
No, I got to start right. Yes. Yeah, see, I did see this movie. Cause I was thinking Possession, like there's so many. Yes. Sam Neill, right?
Sam Neill. Yeah.
Yes. Holy God. You're right. Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, look, this poor Scatman Crothers, you know, he 148 takes of his close up.
Which one? When he's
singing? in the kitchen talking to Danny.
That was 148 takes.
Yeah.
And what do you think Kubrick's trying to do in that moment? I mean, obviously get what he wants, but like, do you think that he does that because, let's say, for example, he wants him to look broken in some way and tired in some way, or you know, and he's just like, I'm gonna do this until I see what I want to see.
I've read a lot of different viewpoints on it. They're probably all true, you know. I don't know. I mean, I think Kubrick was known for he was a photographer before he became a filmmaker, and he was a very respected photographer. And in photography, there's something called bracketing, where you take hundreds of shots of the same angle, like you just keep taking them, and because one of them is going to be the right one. I think Kubrick's attitude was that the least expensive part of making a movie was shooting the scene. Okay. It's an expensive thing to do.
Yeah.
But once you're there and you've built all this stuff and you only have one chance, why are you going, I think we got it at 5.
Right.
Why are you doing that?
Right.
Why aren't you taking a few days to really see? Now, it sounds absolutely absurd until you think about other traditions, like, for instance, theater traditions, where actors rehearse for a very, very long time and then arrive at the performance. In a way, you could say they're just warming up and doing the scene in a rehearsal until they strike kind of like a unique way to do it that's just only could be working in that one moment. And I think he felt it was worth it to just see get as much as he could, you know? And the other thing is that he was known to have a specific style of acting in his movies. He was after having his movies not be like anybody else's movies, including in performance. And the only way you can get that is you got to break an actor of their habits.
Grind it. Yeah.
And Kubrick is the first to say, you know, when he was asked, he goes, look, a lot of actors, they're not prepared. I got to tell you. They come half prepared. And so the first 15 takes are them just getting to know the scene.
I could because see
if
that.
If they know what they're doing, I'm out of there in a couple of takes. But frankly, they're not always that well prepared.
I could see that. And Scatman Crothers, not to assume anything of it, but I'm just saying possibility. He was kind of more of a personality than, actor. Yes. So
Scatman Crothers was known as a song and dance man. Exactly. He was a good actor, but he wasn't like a method actor or anything like that. This
quite
was
know what he was walking into.
Way out of his ballpark in terms of what he was used to.
I asked that question with no aspersions on Kubrick because, like, you know me, I grew up as an athlete. I've been made to run until I puked by coaches. Yeah. I have no problem with pushing myself. In fact, it's kind of a little secret dream I have as an actor is to do that once. Like, I want to work on a project where I might have 140 takes because I don't know what I'm capable of. Everything I've ever done is either commercials. So you get, you know, you shoot it a bunch of times, but it's not because of performance, it's because the coffee cup has to be angled 45 degrees.
Sure. Well, and that's then, going on here too. You know, I mean, that's definitely going on here too.
Precisely,
for instance, you know, in terms of the framing, there are crosshairs in the middle of the frame when you're looking through the camera that are exactly in the middle.
Yep.
And there were arguments apparently between the camera operator and Kubrick after each take about where the crosshair should be. Left nostril, right nostril, center of the nose, cheek, off by a frame, like by a millimeter, and they're doing it again because it's not exactly where he wants that camera to be. Now, you know, that's either that's one person's madman and nightmare. Another person's just like, you know, genius. Like,
I'd like to do it. Right. I'd like to try it once. I would like to be pushed like that. Just once, see what I could do. But, so then I was going to ask you this question. Then this isn't a mistake then, given that, like, there's a scene when, Nicholson like looks directly at camera and he's leaving their room. He just told Wendy, basically, you're not going to ruin my life. He storms out. And as he's walking the door, he shoots a look right at us.
Yep.
Do you know anything about that? Was there any discussion about that they left it?
Never heard anything about it. Other than the fact that, you know, one of the things that Kubrick is looking for when he does those 150 takes of something is moments that are going to be uniquely jarring as well, that you can't plan for. So I think that accusatory look almost looked like it was to Kubrick to me. Yeah. It looked like Nicholson had it that day.
Yeah.
And he was actually like,
is that all right?
Pissed.
You good now? Yeah. Yeah.
And I've seen directors put those looks in a couple movies. And I think they do it just because they're being funny. I think that, you know, I mean, there's a playful side to Kubrick too, where he's kind of, I think he's known to have set up these perfect organized systems. And the reason he's so, you know, anal about it is so that he can go in and then play jazz and kind of have fun.
Right.
Which he does do on set. It's not storyboarded. It's not like prefigured out that way.
I wanted to give a shout out to what I think is an underrated character in all of horror, paranormal movies, whatever. And that's the bartender.
Oh my God. Joe Turkel.
Joe Turkel is like, my God. He is scary, and it's
terrifying.
Like, you couldn't have cast anyone more. Like, he, you know, like, what is it? What is it? That's what, as I'm watching him, I'm like, what is that thing in there behind that human face?
Yes. Yes. I mean, I think what you're looking at is that's doing 80 takes of something, you know, I mean,
he's almost glassy eyed. Like,
I get upset when I hear people like talking about it like it's a frivolous thing, or that he's just didn't do it because he wants to waste people's time, or that he wants to be an impresario, so he does all these takes. And it's like, why would people still be talking about these movies though, unless they were
something?
I mean,
about
these perform you can watch these performances over and over again.
Something about
it's not like Joe Turkel has a lot to do in this movie, but when he shows up, your mind is blown and all he's doing is looking. So what is going on?
Yes.
It's the fact that they're just mining this over and over again to get an actor into a place that you just don't ordinarily see them.
Yes.
Which is a gift to actors, you know, ultimately. To look that good in a movie is a gift. Who gets to look that good?
We've touched on some of the themes that The Shining might be dealing in, which I'm confident we've hit some of the main ones. What's the moral cautionary tale of The Shining? What is The Shining saying at the end of the day?
Well, I don't know. I don't know that he makes moral tales or even cautionary ones. I think he makes examinations of human problems. I think he makes examinations of bad situations. And so there isn't really a lesson in so much as there is, you know, certainly the basic idea of good triumphing over evil here, which does happen. You know, I mean, Wendy saves the day and, you know, the kid outsmarts the father and and he's saved. So that is basic. But I feel like they exist more in terms of an analysis of human conditions and systems that we do that go wrong in our heads and in society and in science and in all kinds of things. Like, he's pretty, you know, Kubrick is the product of fear of nuclear war and the Holocaust, you know? I mean, I think he's a Jewish kid from the Bronx growing up right after World War II. There's a lot of paranoia and terror and fear growing up the way he did. And you can see that in the movies that he makes that are just kind of like examinations of how we come to this situation. Mm. How did we get here?
Yeah.
And so I think, I guess my takeaway is the fairy tale part of it. I always end up feeling swept away by the simplest part of this, which is the Hansel and Gretel, you know, fairy tale thing, which he's also riffing on, you know,
yeah,
with the giant kitchen and the oversized, you know, stuff that everything looks like Alice in Wonderland and those themes. I just think that's
down on the maze and they're,
yeah, it is tremendously powerful. That and the Oedipal family unit struggling. I just find that to be a fascinating part of the movie. And so, yeah. How about you? Do you feel like it, does it speak to you about something different or?
No, I think he was like, again, kind of deconstructing, opening up the wound of repressed damage done by a male figure in a household.
Right.
And trying to say you can sweep these things under the rug. You can go for a geographical cure. You can try to move away. You can try and switch your environs. You can do all that, but the monster is there and it will not be not addressed in some way or the other.
And the monster is something we did as, you know, as white colonizers here. Like that's in the movie too. They built this white palace on top of this Indian burial ground. And it's stated proudly almost like Ullman,
he does say that
scariest guy in the movie for me.
How about that cool outfit he's got on?
Is Ullman and his little secretary, like his little buddy who watches the meeting.
You know, that guy's creepy when he stares at him.
Oh my God.
When he's like, when he first meets Jack, he's like in a suit and everything, an 80s tie and everything. And then when it's like, they're leaving the resort weeks later or whatever. And he's in his like going out clothes. It's like this kind of Nehru leather jacket and he's kind of bell bottoms. Like, what is this guy going to go do right now?
Amazing.
And then he says goodbye to the ladies, like, goodbye, Mr. Smith. Like, goodbye, ladies. Like, oh no.
Yeah. Well, it's all, you know, I mean,
yeah,
to me, this movie is like linked up with both Lolita and with Eyes Wide Shut, because he's got these themes in his movies where you know, there's like the Illuminati cabal of like sex stuff going on behind the scenes with really powerful men controlling stuff. It's in Lolita too, in a smaller way with like Quilty and this horrible pedophile ring that's going on in that story. Mm-hmm. And I mean, these are things that and also the protection of children. Like Kubrick's made a lot of movies about that, about innocence being jeopardized. And a lot of his movies are about women being the higher, the best part of us, like of the species. Women are really celebrated in his movies in a very interesting way. You wouldn't necessarily see it right away because they seem
a little bit rough. If that was one of his goals, like I watch this, and I can't love my wife any more than I do, but it made me feel guilty for little slights. And again, as I said, that kind of whatever that masculinity thing we have, you know, it challenged me in that way. Like, how have I infringed on the peace of my home with that shit, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think he'd be really happy to hear that it makes you, if you're a halfway decent human being and you're trying to pay attention to anything like that.
I mean, this movie is also kind of a black comedy about families.
I had that on my list to ask you about the humor. You have mentioned, when you and I have talked about The Shining in the past, you have mentioned its humor. Where do you see the humor in this movie?
Oh, I see it all over the place. I mean, I mean, it's dark, dark humor.
Yes.
But I see it in Jack Nicholson's character asking for our sympathy. Like, you say he gets jokey at times, and he does. But what I see that is as a tactic of a junkie, essentially, who will do any kind of performance for you in his unreal world to get what he wants, to get you to like him, to get whatever it is.
They're all
and
very charming.
I thought that was you know, some people think that that's over the top, but I've seen people do those things in real life.
Oh,
Nicholson's not like, you know, faking that. It's an extreme version of stuff, but, you know, it's surprisingly real. So I think some people laugh at it like he's supposed to be an anti-hero, but I think it's supposed to just be like, for instance, I laugh when I see her with that giant thing of like Libby's
corn. Yeah.
It's like it's cocktail. It's like fruit cocktail.
Oh yeah, yeah, fruit cocktail. You're right. She's pouring
it's
in
like
the bowl.
It's like a 5 gallon giant, and it's like this joke on an American nuclear family, like with all the appliances being oversized and like her dealing with like the fact that our lives have just become so full of commercialism. It's so huge, like this hotel, it's just too much and it can't sustain. I think that's also another theme in the movie. But almost like pick your way in. There's so many different ways to analyze it. I think.
Incredible, incredible film. It's an incredible, it feels almost like bigger than a film in a way. It's like a piece of therapy and art therapy and history and art and all mixed into one. And Jack is Jack, but sure, he's Jack, man, for a reason, not performance. His bursts of rage. Again, I mentioned her fear being the best fear maybe I've ever seen captured on film. His rage, I would just say rang very true to me.
That shot of him coming down the hallway before he gets his first drink at the bar when he's going, and he's just like
insane. Yes.
Gesticulating in his own... with his, and there's something about just how he's moving. It's disjointed. And you can start to see like the progression of this weird possession that's taking over him. He physically changes so slowly over the course of this movie into a complete monster.
Yes.
Like in The Dead Zone, he becomes this like, he's like limping and he's like bleeding and he's hunched over. He looks, his silhouette looks like a monster, you know, literally.
Yes. Yes.
And he changes, like, to me, my favorite shots in this. Do you have one? Do you have a favorite or because it's so full of them? Like, how do you pick one?
We'll pick one for you and I'll pick one.
Me, it always ends up being the close-ups. Like, out of all these amazing shots, I'm always just like, the ones that blow my mind are just these close-ups of actors going through a transformation that I just can't.
Yeah.
I can't believe they're doing on camera, you know. Jack kills Halloran with the axe and he rises up into that close up and he's gone full possesso, like he is gone, terrifying, probably the shot, you know?
Unbelievable. It's probably a pretty obvious choice, but Danny and his mother play outside and they cut back to Jack. He's wearing the black turtleneck and he's standing in the sun of a window. And he's just
zoom into his close up. I know, it's just beyond belief. And it's more than all the sets and anything going on. Like, that shot just is the one that stays with me. Yeah. Close-ups. Like
almost catatonic, but a little smile comes over his face and then the smile fades. It's just an incredible
take. As is her. Now, I think the best horror scene in history is the all work and no play make Jack and Del Boy scene.
Terrifying.
I think it's that's ever been done anywhere. Her close-up of realization on that is like another one of those.
Incredible.
A perfect example of her fear makes us more afraid.
Yes.
Watching her realize, what is this book? Oh my God, this is... And then seeing her go down the rabbit hole of just how bad this is in that close-up. It's horror heaven, man. It's just absolutely incredible.
What is happening in that man's head that a human being would type that many times? And that it's just horrifying.
Who am I locked in a hotel room with? Like, who am I here with?
Yes, who am I here with? And we just had a big fight about him working. This is what he's been doing all these days. Yeah. Like
it's so much worse than I thought. So much worse.
Yes. Oh, fantastic. Well, Tony, I just want to end this discussion. I've prepared a 20-minute monologue on this movie's direct connection to the Rocky franchise.
I know you have. Let's do it.
Or we can do our top three. Your call. Your call, buddy.
Burgess Meredith was going to play Jack Torrance, actually. I heard he was in the running for a while.
I actually do an impression of the late, great Tony Burton from The Shining, but in Rocky IV. I do him in Rocky IV and I do him in Rocky II, which is maybe my favorite scene when he says to Apollo, he says, "We don't need a man like this in our life, baby. I know what you're feeling. Let it go. Let it go."
That was good.
Thank you. Thank you.
That was really very, very accurate. Chilling almost. Accurate.
He was a great actor. The great Tony Burton. All right, Tony, let's get to our top three baseball bat moments in film history. Do we have a memorial? Do we have the ultimate bat that we want to memorialize this award with? First of all, of course, it's inspired, of course, we don't have to say, by Shelley Duvall and the bat scene in this film.
I don't know. I mean, to me, this is the bat, but you know,
yeah, so it's, she should be the memorial award.
I think so.
Stop it! Give me the bat. Stop swinging the bat.
Please stop.
Give me the bat.
Wendy.
Die. Give me the bat. Give me the bat.
Ah, God damn!
Or maybe I was thinking Roy Hobbs from The Natural, like that bat with the lightning bolt on it. With Robert.
Oh, Benson. The Natural. Well, yeah, that was a good bat. That was okay. Good. Yeah. I definitely went with bats that weren't being used in a sportsmanlike way.
I figured. I did too. In honor of Shelley and The Shining. All right. So who goes first? You want to go first?
Sure. Okay. My number one is the bats from the movie The Warriors. There's a gang, the baseball fans.
Mm-hmm.
And they have great costumes and bats, and that's their weapon of choice. And that scared the hell out of me when I was a kid. That was just terrifying. And those bats and costumes made a big impression.
Were they also on roller skates, or was that a different gang?
I think they were on roller skates.
Yeah, yeah.
Somebody was on roller skates. Yeah,
they were like dead baseball players, right? They had like
cool masks and like
great call. Yeah, that's terrifying. That's imagine being like 1970s New York and coming upon a group of kids.
I saw that too young, and I lived in New York, and I was like, this is actually happening.
My number three comes from a quirky little funny scene in the movie Superbad, the comedy that I kind of adore. It's like a guilty pleasure. It's hilarious. And they are running from a party. They've stolen beer from a party. He's got the beer in actually laundry detergent cases. And they run through someone's backyard, and it's one of those shots you expect to stop. That's what's so funny about it, because he runs to the edge of the fence. He's got the bat. He goes, "You sons of bitches!" And it should cut right there. But then there's like an extra beat. The father throws the bat. The bat goes pinwheeling through the air and hits him in the back. And he goes, "Oh, what the fuck!"
I remember that. Yeah,
always
that was
struck
funny.
Me as funny. Oh, great bat moment.
Bats are fun.
They are fun.
My number two. From the underseen movie Identity, starring John Cusack. We don't see the bat in action, but we do see what somebody did to somebody with the bat. And it's horrific beyond all belief. It's just horrifying.
So you see,
you can look that up.
After Effects. I don't think I saw Identity.
Somebody uses it basically to perform a tonsillectomy. Let's put it that way.
Got it. Okay. And it's okay. I'll have to check that one out. I like John Cusack. I never saw
it. It's a really good movie. That's actually a really worth it movie. Identity.
Good call. Cool. I love those deep pulls. Oh, Ray Liotta's in that too. My number two comes from another comedy, actually, Tony. This is another comedy. Great use of a bat by Randall Tex Cobb in Ace Ventura, Pet Detective.
Excellent. And I love Tex Cobb.
He's
fantastic.
He destroys Ace Ventura's car with a baseball bat as Ace Ventura's trying to get away. And then the scene ends with Ace Ventura's famous line, and the car finally starts. And he goes, "It's alive," mocking the Frankenstein scene. And it's just hilarious.
I got to see that again.
Yeah. Tex Cobb, baby, goes to town on that car.
Love Tex Cobb. He's so good in Raising Arizona too.
Oh, hilarious.
Lone Biker of the Apocalypse. So my number one is Untouchables. It's De Niro just going to town at a board meeting. It's shocking. Remember that the one of the most shocking moments in a movie for me. I saw it when it came out and you know, I wasn't a kid, but like I was just like, that was the De Niro moment for me in my life growing up, where I was like, oh, he's terrifying.
Same.
Oh, God. Same. Yeah. Yeah.
Enthusiasms. Enthusiasms. Did you say something like that? A man must have enthusiasms. Crack.
Amazing.
And I think you know what my number one is going to be probably as soon as we made the list, but Swing Away, Meryl. From Signs, You know,
I knew you were doing it.
Oh my God. I just, you know, what better use of a baseball bat could you have? I know a lot of people that saw that movie and saw it coming from Jump Street. Almost as soon as they saw the bat on the mantle and they talked about his baseball career, they go, oh, he's going to use the bat. I didn't see it coming at all. It made me emotional when I saw it. I fell for it, hook, line, and sinker. I just love that moment.
It's good stuff, man. It's good stuff. I don't know if I saw it coming either, to be honest. But I don't know about sports, so I probably didn't know what it was. Like, is that a fishing rod? What is that?
Is that a cricket bat? Does he play cricket? Speaking of which, some honorable mentions. Cricket bat, Shaun of the Dead. It's still a bat.
Yeah. Right? It's true. Very, very much worth it. Yeah. Casino has apparently a very loved bat moment.
Oh, God.
That's rough. That's really rough.
That, like, really, like, I couldn't watch that scene again.
But, I mean, it's a great gore, yes, like, effects moment for sure.
Yes.
But it doesn't have the same De Niro. It's like, it's still Untouchables just beats it to me because it's just so fast and, yes, and surprising and, like, oh, my, yes, God, I can't. Yeah.
All right, Tony. So obviously Shining, I don't even think we need to save this episode. It gets a P for paranormal. It's going on the shelf.
On the shelf.
Could get its own shelf, for goodness sake. What are we going to look at next week? We've coming off the heels of a monster classic.
Yeah, I think this coming up week, we're going to do something current, like a new streaming show, right? We picked Archive 81, which is a show that both of us find intriguing and we're looking forward to finishing up, because I think we both started it, but we want to really dive in.
Correct. So stream Archive 81. It's a newish show and it's paranormal themed and we're going to have a blast. Thank you, everybody, for playing along. We want to hear from you. We got some comments about Tony's UFO picture. People believe that it's something, by the way, Tony, I forgot to mention.
Oh, really? Oh, good. Yet. Okay.
So we'll keep this train rolling. Thank you, Tony.
Thank you, Maddie. Onward and sideways.
Enthusiasms.
We hope you've enjoyed this edition of Rated P for Paranormal. Please rate, review, and share. It really does make a difference. For more information, to participate, and even donate, go to our main page, anchor.fm/ratedparanormal. On social media, we're at Rated Paranormal. All music is by Andrew Galdens Jr. You can find him on Instagram at Kid Riga, or go to therocketscience.bandcamp.com. This podcast was created, written, produced, and edited by Maddie Blake and Anthony Arkin.
Let it go. That was good. All I even needed is something like this. Okay.